So if you purchased a ticket, you're making us able to do that. And if you are somebody who supports Art Power, and if you're not, we hope you'll consider it and you like that. We think those change makers need to have art in their lives so that they solve those problems with compassion, with empathy, with creativity, and all the things that art does to make us whole humans. So, you don't want to keep clapping because it'll take longer, so don't clap for me anymore. We're going to get to the goods. I do want to mention two organizations, the Arthur C. Clarke Center for Human Imagination. If you are a science or science fiction lover or just imagination and creativity lover, please look them up. They do incredible, mind-blowing work. And the other partner I want to mention is, of course, the Old Globe Theater. The Old Globe is such a gift to our community. They have two shows running now, and then an incredible season. It's never been more important to buy a ticket to theater. Please, please support the work that they are doing. Now I'm going to introduce the first of two esteemed gentlemen on the stage. Barry Edelstein is the Erna Finzi Viterbi Artistic Director of the Old Globe Theater. He's a director, a producer, author, educator, wildly recognized as one of the leading American authorities on the works of Shakespeare. He's directed nearly half of the Bard's plays, worked with incredible actors. I'm going to keep moving through. He's got two books, so please check them out. Thinking Shakespeare, which is now the standard text on American acting in Shakespeare. And he's the author of Bardisms, Shakespeare for All Occasion, which does sound like fun and sounds like a great holiday gift. He has taken the Old Globe and Shakespeare into every corner of San Diego, to schools, to senior centers, to prisons and beyond. He's incredible. We're so lucky to have him. He was the first and only person we thought of to moderate this conversation. Please help me welcome to the stage, Barry Edelstein.
Shakespearean sonnet that's been on my mind since I knew I was going to do this event. It's sonnet number 144. And the first line is, two loves I have, of comfort and despair. And it's a sonnet about a guy who's in love with two people and how they make him feel. It's on my mind because I have my own paraphrase of that sonnet. And it goes, two loves I have, of Shakespeare and Star Trek. Both of those things. He's written a memoir called Making It So, which is absolutely wonderful. It's a beautiful and beautifully written book that's about family and friendship. It's about showbiz and art. It's about England and America, and it's about Shakespeare and Star Trek. And the fact that I get to talk to him for the next hour is the greatest Hanukkah present that has ever been received in the history of the universe. Please, welcome to San Diego and to the stage, Sir Patrick Stewart. Wonderful. It's really wonderful. I've read a bunch of celebrity memoirs. It's very moving. It's extremely revealing. It's very personal about your life and your childhood. But most important, it's just wonderfully written, and you wrote it yourself. You did not hire a ghostwriter. Can you talk about that? Why? Why not just do what the rest of the movie stars do? Have somebody else do the heavy lifting?
Books have been very important in my life, Barry, from the age of about 6. And when I was 7, I accidentally discovered that my little town in the West Riding of Yorkshire in North England had a library. And I just went along there one Saturday morning, and people were so kind to me, and they took me in. They said, yes, you can be a member. You're a little bit young, but we'd be happy to make you a member. And they took me to the children's section. Well, that was interesting, and I selected 2 books, and I would go there every Saturday, return the 2 books which I had always read, and get 2 more. And then I discovered the adult section. And I was hooked. And particularly with American literature, 20th century American literature really got me going. And not just books about Raymond Chandler, my dad. I love those books.
Yeah.
They remain. I have 3 books that are about that thick that I'm reading at the moment,
which are.
Okay, you can do this, Patrick.
That's okay.
One of them is this is embarrassing, but I wish I could show you the book. I wish I had it with me. It's about UFOs. I mean, you think I made that up? It's not true. This is a book published this year, and it's huge. And it is the whole history of unidentified flying objects. And I'm hoping.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize there had been so many observations and sightings, so many, over the 20th century particularly.
And there's, I'm sure, a secret vault somewhere where the evidence is sealed up, right?
Well, it could be. I mean, one of the theories was that it was all under the control of the Royal Air Force. And, the Royal Air Force in England and the
US Air Force here.
US Air Force here. It's fascinating. That's one of them. The other one is a book by James Baldwin. Might have been his first book. Published in 1961, so it's over 60 years old now.
Great.
And the third book that I'm reading is...
It's okay, you can shout it out when you...
Can't remember?
No problem. But I want to talk about your book, because it's in a way, it gets into showbiz and Star Trek and Hollywood, once you reach that point in your life. But the first half of the book reads much more like a novel. You were a journalist for a hot minute when you were younger, and you do still have a gift of conjuring place and people with a real novelist's eye for detail. It's very impressive. And your childhood was kind of stunningly novelistic. Your wife called it a Victorian childhood.
Yes, that's right, it was. And Sunny, my wife, has used this term quite a lot since we were married 10 years ago, because I leaked my childhood out to her little by little, because I knew that there were people in my life who had been disturbed by my stories about my childhood. I didn't want to disturb her, but yes. So, why was it Victorian?
Yeah.
Well, I was born in 1940, and I was born in July of 1940, And quite recently, I thought, you know, my father went to the war, although he didn't have to because he was older than was the set age for conscripting soldiers. But he joined up. So, and I was born in July, and I did the calculations backwards. And I realized, you know where I'm going. I realized that it is very probable that I was conceived the night before my father went to war. And it moved me. So, the first 5 years of my life, I was without a father. I have been told that he came home on leave when I was about 14 months or 15 months old, because he was in the attack on the Nazis in France, which led to Dunkirk, the drama of Dunkirk. And my father was there, but he wasn't actually at Dunkirk, a little bit further south in France. But I didn't really get to know him until the war was over, and by which time I was five. We lived in a house in a yard, a cinder yard. You went up some steps to this raised area, and there were five houses around this yard, and they were all the same. And they were called, it was a local terminology, one up, one down. So there was one room on the ground floor, and the front door opened up straight into that room. And in front of you was another door, which led up a stone staircase to the upper room, just one room. There was no kitchen, no toilet. We had limited electricity and no running hot water. And this was the Victorian.
That's why you went to the Victorian.
I think probably it's enough of that.
Now your father looms large in the book, as he, of course, loomed large in your life. Those 5 years when he was away and you were with your mother were idyllic, bucolic,
and paradise.
Paradise. Then he came home and it got dark. It got dark. He was a tough guy. He was abusive. He was drunk. He was hard to you and your brother.
I find this very difficult.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. I'm glad that I've been able to talk about it in recent years, because for a long time I couldn't. But I only discovered about 6 years ago that, and this was by an army doctor who officially told me when he had been researching my father's life, particularly life in the military, that he was a classic case of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, which was in those days called shell shock.
Right.
And when I told him more about my father's behavior, how he retired in 1945, he was the regimental sergeant major of the parachute regiment, the most senior non-commissioned officer in the British Army. And I was told by, I met once or twice people who actually had served, and their tales about his work and his manner and his attitude and commitment was extraordinary. The story that I was told that I enjoy more than any other, this man, I met him in the street in Murphy, the little town where I was brought up. I don't live there anymore. And he said to me, can we go and have a beer somewhere? And because I'd love to talk to you about your dad. And so he did. But the one thing he said to me that stuck with me all that time was, you know, when your father walked onto the parade ground, the birds in the trees stopped singing.
Yeah, that's a great, great line. Your family lived in real poverty. poverty. And one of the moving moments in the book is that your father got an opportunity to have a big job in London, and it would have changed the family's fortunes.
Oh, significantly.
Yeah.
But what else might it have changed? He was told by one of his officers with whom he was attached when the war was finally coming to an end in 1945. And this man said, "What are you going to do, Alfred, my father's name, when you get back to England?" And Dad said, "I don't know, I'll find a job somewhere." He said, "Well, look, I happen to know that the man who is the primary doorman of the Dorchester Hotel in London is going to retire in 2 years' time. And when he does, if you want to start right away working as his assistant, when he leaves, you can have his job. I've already discussed it with the hotel, and they think it's great. Regimental Sergeant Major." And he went home and told my mother, and she refused to leave Armand the whole time. She was frightened.
Yeah.
She was a very shy, quiet person. And she said, no, I can't. I couldn't live there. Well, what I never fully understood is why he didn't say was, "Well, you know, in fact, you don't have to come and live there. It'll be my job. I'll work there, and I'll come home whenever I can." That didn't work out. So it was a difficult time. And yes, indeed, he became a weekend alcoholic. So Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday nights were very difficult. And he was violent, and the only person he was violent with was my mother. And more than once we had to call ambulances. Well, I say we had, there was one person in our yard who had a telephone. We didn't have telephones. And they called the police, and they called the ambulance.
And you've since done really important activism and work in the world of domestic abuse, right? You've been
Yes.
Very powerful.
Yeah. I was approached actually to write a little introduction to a book about domestic violence. I never talked about it, so it was just a coincidence. And I learned about what they did. I went to their head offices. I heard their procedures with regard to dealing with domestic violence, particularly as it mostly was husbands attacking wives. And I so admired the work that they did that I said, "I'd like to come on board." So I became an official of the Great Charity of the organization. And I feel that I'm doing for my mother. But there are things I do for my father occasionally as well that I know he would have liked. He would have loved to have seen me play Captain Jean Renard.
I told you that we have a mutual friend, the late Roger Rees, one of the great Shakespeare actors, a member of the late Shakespeare. Roger, who's had been at the Old Globe a couple of times and a really, really dear friend. And Roger, like you, was a working class English kid, son of a policeman. And I remember I directed him in a play, and in his dressing room on his mirror, he had a photo of the crew of the Enterprise. And it was signed to Roger, and I remember, I think it might have actually said, "Love, Patty." And I said, "Patty, is that Patrick Stewart?" He said, "Yes, well, you know, he's a working class kid. We never called him Patrick. You know, he had a nickname." And the both of you sort of have this relationship to a childhood in poverty where people said to you, "The acting world is not for you. It's not for you. You can't go there." And through the benevolence of, in particular, and I'm very moved by your dedication to teachers, somehow you broke through. There was a change in England, you know, Albert Finney and the Angry Young Men, and suddenly working class actors started getting work.
Yes.
But I would love you to talk about the, it's hard for us, I think, in the United States now to conceive of those class barriers that prevented actors, people of your background, from going into this line of work.
Yeah. If you were working class and you were funny, that was all right, because you could do comedy. If you were not funny, forget it. It was very much a class prejudiced profession. But it was already changing when I went to drama school. I went to a secondary modern school, which was the lowest level of education that was available when I was young. And it's not because I failed the 11 plus, which was an examination that every child had to take. And this would be an indication of whether you were grammar school quality. In other words, academic.
I see.
And I lived very close to the grammar school, and I didn't like the kids that I met. they always wore uniforms, and of course I never wore a uniform. Well, I did, right at the end of my schooling, I did. And I forgot where I was going.
There's a wonderful sequence in the book where something really important happens that allows you, without, you know, two pennies to rub together. And you get accepted to a drama school, and you're told, well, you gotta live, it's out of town, you gotta get a bus ticket, you gotta have some clothes to bring, and you apply to the local government for a grant. And there's this wonderful sequence in the book where you're wondering, is it gonna happen? And then like the seas parted, you find out that the local council gives you a full ride to go study drama. Without that, you would not be sitting here right now. And I just love the idea that public arts funding has made Captain Picard possible.
What's happening in England is not good in that respect. The commitment to the arts has unraveled, and particularly to the theatre. So many theatres have closed. And I understand that even the Royal Shakespeare Company have been in a certain amount of trouble recently. I'll be honest and I'll tell you the story. When the day of the 11 plus came around, I think this is all in the book, I set off to walk to the school, which was only half a mile away. And it was a pleasant walk because our town was a small little town on a river and a canal and railway line went through it. And when I got to a T-junction, where to the right was my school, and I could already hear my pals in the playground. And on the left, the road went down into the valley, across the river, across the canal, across the railway lines, and up into the hills. And that's where I went. It's not something I'm proud of.
Why do you think you did it? Fear, you know, apprehension?
I knew that was a world I didn't want to be in.
I see.
That world of class.
Yeah.
Because if you, growing up where I grew up, if you were clever, it was almost certainly that you had a family who had been able to pay for some of your education or get tutors in and so forth, all of that. And the 11 plus exam was a critical one because it could make a total difference to the beginning of your life. Well, I went home after that. My mother had made me some sandwiches to eat for lunch in the middle of the exams, and I sat up in the hills above, on the edge of a field, with my back against the wall and the sun was shining. It was only May, and I could see my town down there. In fact, there's a photograph of it in there. And I could even see my friends running around in the playing field of the school. And I went home, and my mother said to me, "How did it go, love?" And I said, "Oh, we're all right." And then, of course, they found out because one of the teachers came that evening and said, "Where were you? What happened to you?" I didn't know that they were betting on me to get a good exam result, but I hadn't even sat it. Now, there is a member of my family who claims that I've made this story up. If you should run into this person,
okay, I'll
don't really worry about it.
Back to the discovery of Shakespeare, which I can very much relate to. You know, I'm also of working class background and went to public schools and discovered this writing that made me feel like the things that I thought and had no idea how to say finally had a language, that there was finally a way that I could express myself through this material that was 400 years old. And you have this great vignette in the book where you're assigned by a teacher to speak the words of Shylock, and you're trying to figure it out. Can you tell that story?
Yes. You've already now mentioned the two people to whom the book is dedicated. The first was Cecil Dorman, who was in my second year at the Lovell Secondary Modern School. He was my English teacher for the last 3 years I was in school there. And I had an acting teacher from the age of 13 called Ruth Wynne Owen, who is also a dedicatee in the book.
Yes.
And one day, Cecil, he was full of surprises, and he was a humorous and light-hearted man. All his students adored him. And he knew how to have fun with us, but keep control, you know. And he had his pile of books in his hand, and he was going around looking at the desks, and then he'd bang a book down on the desk, and he'd say a name. Well, I think I was the last person to get this book, and I saw that it was a copy of a Shakespeare play, and so I knew what it was. And he banged it down in front of me and said, "Patrick Shylock." I never read Shakespeare, ever, not a line of it. I'd heard it because the radio, BBC radio in those days, 40s and 50s, was fantastic. And of course, no advertising at all. which I know is necessary and required these days. But I opened it up. He said, "Act 4, Scene 2. Which is Shylock's triumph scene.
The big climactic
scene. The center of the play. And he said, all right, Cecil Dorman said, "Start reading." And Shylock doesn't speak at the very beginning of the scene. But we all went. And Cecil Dorman said, "Not to yourselves, you idiots! This is a play, it's drama, it's life, it's real. Now, let's go back to the beginning and start reading it again." Well, I turned a couple of pages, and suddenly there was the name, Shylock. And there was the speech, which I have since then discovered, was 36 lines long. I had no idea what the speech was about, except that this man was somehow defending himself. And I couldn't pronounce the words. I was utterly confused, but something in the rhythm of what I was attempting, and this was all about feeling, not mental, not understanding, not conception. It was a kind of pleasant, rolling feeling of the language. And I began to do it more. My curate of the church in which I was a choir boy had given me a complete works of Shakespeare. It was old and tattered and huge. And I would just dip into it. And when I was on my own, I would read aloud from it. And because I enjoyed having the words in my mouth, and I still do, and it gave me feeling, positive feeling, and not just having to be a student and study.
Right.
I loved it.
It's you do it uncommonly well, I have to say. and I'm not, about Shakespeare and what Shakespeare means to you, but can I just sidebar over just to your voice? You know, you have just this extraordinary voice, distinctive and powerful. And we in America, we're suckers for people who sound like you. But that's not it. Can I just tell you a little story? So you lived in Brooklyn for a while, right? Parks.
Oh yeah.
I lived in Williamsburg. And when I would give people directions to my house, I would say, walk east on Metropolitan Avenue, turn left on Memorial Gore. Now, Memorial Gore is a little park of Gore. It's a triangular piece of land made by a road that splits, like Kensington Gore, right?
Yes.
And I sounded so dumb. Turn left at Memorial Gore. Turn left at Memorial Gore. So I started giving people directions to my house as you. I would say, walk east on Metropolitan Avenue, turn left at Memorial Gore. My wife's here. She can attest to it. So, you know, maybe backstage, if you could, for a Hanukkah gift, just say Memorial Gore.
I would like to say something else. I don't always do this, but I think tonight it feels the right thing to do, is to speak a few lines of Shakespeare.
Oh, please.
It's just a sonnet, so it's not drama. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love, which alters when an alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh, no, it is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark whose worth's unknown. Although his height be taken, love's not time's fool. Though roses and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come, love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error, and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved.
We did all sorts of stuff. I did a series on the sonnets. That really helped. It really helped. It helped, speaking only for myself, maybe I speak for others, it made that terrible time less terrible. Something about someone standing up and saying, in this moment of crisis, in this moment of illness, in this moment of death, I'm going to stand up for beauty, I'm going to stand up for something eternal. That was a huge gift that you gave to the world, and we're all so grateful.
It wasn't my idea. One day, my wife and I were out for a walk, I think maybe we might have been shopping or something, I don't know. But because Shakespeare floats into my head, it actually did it while I was sitting back here, and I can't now remember what the lines were, but something just went so we were going along, and that was the song, actually, I was going to say, to the marriage and true minds of middle peddlers. And my wife said, what's that? And I said, oh, it's a song, I don't know where it came from, I just suddenly thought of the first line. And she said, well, go on, I said, do it all, do you know it all? And I said, no, maybe. So I recited the sonnet for her as we held hands and walked down the street, which was a nice place to be with words like love is not love when it alters, like an alteration finds. And she said, you know what, you should post this. Then I want to film it. She stopped at the side and said, look, there's not many people out. I want to do this, and then we're going to post it. Now, I didn't do social media or anything like that. I do now much more, but I have two people who work with me on it. And then she said, and we did it. We filmed it. We posted it. It erupted. Yeah. And then the day that happened, she said to me, you should read them all. One a day. And not knowing what I was learning myself, I agreed to do it. And then, here is the best part of this story. So many of you know that I did the sonnets. And that alone is totally justification. It would not be so much.
Was there a moment in your childhood when you discovered you had this great, wonderful, resonant baritone voice? I mean, what, you know, you sold furniture for a while, you know, were you telling people, there's a desk?
There are four legs.
What I do remember, and I hope you remember this, I had a friend called Fred Fisher, and he was my age, and when I had started doing amateur acting, he didn't have anything to do with it. But he did say, you know, Patrick, you're going to have to learn to talk differently. And of course, he was right. And then my teacher said the same thing. And she gave me instruction in received pronunciation, RP.
RP,
yeah. Yeah. And it helped me immensely. But I do remember a friend saying to me at one point, you know, Patrick, that bloody noise that you make, you should stop doing that. It doesn't sound like you. Anyway, I'm very proud of my Yorkshire background, and I'm very proud of being able to do the accent and some of the dialect, because we didn't just speak with accents. We use different words.
Different language.
Shall I give you one?
Please.
There's an instance which I always enjoy, and so does my wife, which is, I Now let me see, which one shall I do for you? Oh yes, going to my friend's house to ask him out, knocking on the door, he would come to the door and I would say to him, I'd like it out.
What?
I'd like it out. Atta, art thou? Because in my family we said thee and thou.
He said thee and
you didn't say thee to my father.
No, you killed right.
All of you, if you did, because it was an insult.
Right.
Atta art thou lakin. Lakin is at least a 14th century word, which literally meant, when it was being used, player. And Shakespeare's company, his own acting company that he was part of, they were known as Lakers.
Ah.
Atta, Lakin, Art. Art is out, is the way we said out. And it's...
It meant, do you want to come play, is what it meant.
Yeah, you're coming out to play, and Lakin Art.
Wow.
And there were lots like that. Okay, where there's muck, there's brass.
Wow. What?
Where there's dirt, there's money. Hear all, see all, send out. Ain't all, sup all, pay none. And if ever that is out for note, do it for this end. If ever you do something for nothing, do it for yourself.
Wow.
That's how I talk.
We don't train actors in art anymore, right? We embrace the sound that people bring, and it makes Shakespeare a richer sound, to my ear.
I think that's right. I often enjoy playing with accents on certain roles that I have played. It's very interesting that the London, the Cockney accent really works with Shakespeare, which is probably the closest sound we have today to how people talked 400 years ago.
Yeah. So I've always been really interested, because I can't let this evening go by without some serious Star Trek, but I've been really interested in the connection between Shakespeare and Star Trek. The original series has a lot of episodes named for Star Trek episodes. There's an episode where a group of traveling players comes onto the Enterprise and they do a scene of Shakespeare. I guess Roddenberry liked Shakespeare. He cast you, you say, there's a scene from Henry V in The Next Generation, you quote Hamlet in The Next Generation, the final episode of Picard, you quote Julius Caesar. In the original series movies, you have the Undiscovered Country, right? And Christopher Plummer quoting, saying that Shakespeare was originally written in Klingon. So I'm really, really interested in why you think there's this, if you think, and if so, why there's any kind of parallel between Shakespeare and the universe of Star Trek.
Well,
or am I out of my mind?
Picard was a man who was devoted to books. You may remember in the Ready Room, there were bookshelves with books, well, not like that, but, but books that were way out of date because he collected them. And there was, and this was my doing, I found a very, very old copy of The Complete Works of Shakespeare, and it was in the bookshelf on the Enterprise for 7 years. I still got it.
There are plays about leadership, and so Picard's a leader. There's military stuff in the plays. There's the human experience. There's, you know, it makes sense to me that the two worlds kind of rhyme with each other.
It's never been presented to me in such detail as you just have now. I think it's fascinating, and I shall give it a lot of thought.
Okay.
But my sense is, and I don't mean to be nasty about this, but I don't think this was necessarily Gene Roddenberry's contribution.
I see.
I think it might have come from Robert... Oh, come on, Patrick. Who was one of the producers? He was a producer of the original series.
I see.
And there was one other producer. And they were the ones, I think, who were behind the pleasure and cheekiness of adding little bits of Shakespeare into it.
Right.
And for one thing, they knew that I loved it.
And one of my favorite details of Star Trek trivia is that William Shatner was a Shakespearean actor in Stratford before he became the captain of the
Enterprise.
Yeah? They like to speechify. If you're on the bridge of the Enterprise, you give a speech, you inspire people, right?
Yes, and also he wasn't an American either.
No, Canadian. You know, the book, one of the things about the book that I really love is that one way to read this book, and I suppose one would say to read your life, is it's a story about a guy who's rather serious, who learns how to have fun. And it's really, in some sense, that kind of tracks in the book when you, from England versus America, loosen up when you come to California. Is that fair? Would you say that the journey of your life, in particular in your professional life, has been to release and learn to have a little fun?
It may not have been the primary element, but it was certainly there. There's no question of that. And as I get older and older and older, I find that I get more pleasure out of laughter than I've ever done in my life. Although I loved the comedy shows on BBC Radio when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I mean, this story is well known now about me calling the meeting of all the other actors on Star Trek.
Can you tell that story? It's a great story.
Well, I assume that quite a lot of this audience but I was very concerned that there was too much fooling around on the set in the first season. And I was there working away, trying to be this super intelligent, very compassionate, but very determined leader of a crew and the captain of the Enterprise. But where was I going? See, this happens for me.
That's okay. The story about how serious you were and
yes.
you gave a speech
yes,
to the
yes.
company about
that. That's right. How serious I was, yes. when I complained to the actors, and then one of them said, "Oh, come on, Patrick, we've got to have some fun." And I said, and I actually hit the arm of the chair I was sitting in, "We are not here to have fun!" On that afternoon, there was a stunned silence. And then they all started to laugh. Jonathan, Brent, and Michael at the bar, and Kate, Marina, they started to laugh. And I stormed out of the room. But they got to work on me. And I talked a lot. Jonathan and Brent, particularly, had a big influence on my lightening up. Are you showing me that you could have fun and do even better work because of the fun that you have?
That's great. Also, those days are long, right? Making a television show long. You did 107? How many episodes did you do? A crazy number of episodes.
I'm not really sure, but I think it was 150, 160.
Yeah, so how could you, if you were to try and maintain that level of seriousness for all that time, you'd go crazy.
Yes.
To learn how to release a little bit.
I am proud to say that by season three, I was the most jokey person. In fact, I came up, I did call another meeting because they've all quoted, "We're not here to have fun." I mean, they still haven't thrown at me today. We're a wonderful group. We love each other so much. And we're going to be getting together, a handful of us, in a couple of weeks' time. I can't wait.
Great.
And I said, look, there's something I want us to do. I think that each one of us should be responsible for one big laugh every day. And we've got to come up with it. So that's 8 or 9 big laughs in the day. And we did. We took it, but everybody took it very seriously.
How did the directors who had to get the shots in? Yeah, probably.
I do remember one director finally falling on his knees and saying, "Please, just say the first line." Of course, he was fooling too, but he also meant it. I learned to laugh and work at the same time. And relish it. And I mean, there were times when we would laugh and we couldn't stop. We would just laugh. And yes, there were difficulties.
Yeah. Well, the love among the crew is so amazing. You know, I don't know how many of you have seen Picard. It's fantastic. But there's an episode where you all go get back on the bridge of the Enterprise. It just, I wept. I was like, oh my God, get back, my friends, I love them. You know, and the love among the crew is so palpable.
Yeah. One of us certainly wept. It wasn't me, but somebody did. Because I knew when the set was being completed, we had 3 stages that we worked on continually at Paramount. And I knew that something was coming up. I got lost again.
The scene where the crew walks onto the bridge.
Oh yeah, that's right. And there was such emotion in the crew. Because even though it was just a set of a futuristic space travel machine, but it had an intimacy about it, and those chairs and the one in the center back and the position where Michael Dorn stood and where LeVar was down here, and then LeVar became the number one engineer and was in charge of all of the engines and so forth. It was hard for people to believe how seriously we took all of that.
Yeah, well, that's what makes it work.
Yeah.
So we're coming near the end of our time, sadly, but I do want to ask you something, and I ask this partly out of self-interest, which is, any Shakespeare plays you want to do? I run a beautiful Shakespeare theater.
He came to see me one morning and said, Patrick, I'm not feeling very well. And with a press night tomorrow night, I just don't think I can do tonight's show. So I just thought I'd let you know.
Wow.
I hadn't learned it.
No!
Because he was so energetic and strong, I didn't want to spend my time learning. And he said to me, what's wrong? And I said, I've hardly rehearsed it. I've hardly thought about it. He said, then don't worry. And he did that night's performance.
He did?
Yeah. And he made it through the press nights.
Right.
I was so grateful to him. But I think Falstaff, certainly in Henry IV, Part 1 and 2, might just be the best older character in the whole show.
One of the greatest.
More than Lear, more than Macbeth. He is so complex.
Yeah.
And there are so many different aspects and elements to him that I think it would be, and I've also got a couple of ideas on how to do it. But,
summer 2025. Thanks everybody for coming out. I want to thank UCSD, Art Power, and the Old Globe. We've been asked to have a photographer come out.
Oh, yeah.
So we should do that. And hey, thanks everybody for being here. Sir Patrick Stewart.